This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it feels like we've been through a tumultuous year in the world of health policy, and I suspect we'll see more of the same in the year to come. While the Affordable Care Act faced several near-death experiences in 2017, it was battered, but still standing at the end of all of it. Two attempts to repeal the law failed. There was no small achievement considering the forces aligned in Washington committed to seeking its repeal.
And, you know, Mark, there was another, I thought, kind of notable event, and that was that in spite of a significantly shortened open enrollment period for coverage in 2018, close to 9 million Americans managed to sign up for coverage in just 6 weeks. I thought that was a pretty impressive achievement.
It showed that not only have the online exchanges matured in just a couple of years, consumers who navigate them seem to have gotten better at it, but we're still facing a lot of uncertainty. The tax reform bill that passed just before Christmas has eliminated the individual mandate requiring all Americans to carry health insurance, and that is expected to impact coverage in the coming years.
The Congressional Budget Office predicts that we could see 13 million Americans drop out of coverage over the next decade because of that. Some will simply choose not to buy coverage, but many more, it's likely, will be forced out of buying coverage on the exchanges because it will be too expensive for them to purchase, especially those with costly pre-existing condition. And that, of course, is what underlay the entire movement for the universal mandate.
2017 also saw an unprecedented number of natural disasters impact America and its territories.
Well, those back-to-back hurricanes wrought havoc on infrastructure and health systems in Texas, and of course, especially in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. And 2017 was also the year that the true scope of the opioid crisis really came into focus in America. Opioid overdose is now the leading cause of accidental death in this country, and the numbers are continuing to get worse.
You know, we've really been fortunate to have some pretty terrific guests on the show this past year to address all of these big challenges. So we thought we'd take a look back, revisit some of those conversations. There were great challenges, but also some exciting advances in things like gene editing, telehealth, technologies that are certain to disrupt the status quo in years to come.
And whether it was GOP strategists like Michael Levitt or Lanhe Chen, public health officials like Louisiana Health Secretary Dr. Rebecca Gee, we learned so much from all of our guests this past year. Looking forward to tapping back into some of those moments.
As well, we are always blessed to have Lori Robertson stop by. She's the managing editor of factcheck.org, is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love to hear from you.
We'll get to our look back at 2017 in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. 2018 is starting off with more questions than answers regarding health policy. Funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, was added in a last-minute budget resolution before the holiday, which essentially approved enough money to keep the program going until the end of March. Funding for CHIP actually ran out at the end of September, and many states were concerned the lack of reauthorization of CHIP funding by Congress would have led to millions of vulnerable American children losing health coverage. CHIP covers health care for some 9 million children, and a number of states were bracing for necessary cuts to the program if Congress didn't act. A number of child advocacy organizations, such as the Children's Defense Fund and the March of Dimes, warn that playing with CHIP funding like this is causing great uncertainty and will most certainly impact children's health. The Trump administration has stripped away another Obama-era measure, scaling back the use of fines to nursing homes that harm residents. 4 in 10 nursing homes have been fined for violations since 2013 under the Obama measure. Under the Trump administration's guidelines, nursing home regulators are being urged not to levy fines or actions, even in a case where a death has occurred at a nursing home facility. On the heels of the Apple Heart Study, genomics testing company 23andMe is looking to launch a large-scale study on genetics and obesity. The weight loss intervention study is launching at the start of peak weight loss season, seeking 100,000 participants using 23andMe's personal genomics platform to help researchers analyze genetic components to obesity and how they might impact effectiveness of different weight loss protocols. It's the first time a study has chosen to look at genomic determinants of weight loss. Last year, 23andMe set the stage for this year's study, launching the first genomic weight report, looking at genomic data as well as behavioral data to determine who is more likely to gain weight. This information shows how people's specific genetics may influence their own responses to not only exercise and make certain food choices, but also factors like sleep and stress. And speaking of genetics, researchers are looking at new ways to tackle HIV using genetically modified cells programmed to attack the virus, the science based on recent gene editing used in cancer treatment. Scientists using genetically modified CAR cells managed to nearly eradicate the virus in lab animals, signaling what could be a new approach to attacking HIV. The global research community has tried unsuccessfully for decades to create an AIDS vaccine. The result of this new development is being called modest, but a potentially promising new approach. I'm Ariane O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We are marking the end of 2017, a pivotal year in healthcare, a year that began with the inauguration of President Trump and ended without repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Surprisingly, with all of the uncertainty over health policy this past year, we thought it would be a good idea to revisit some of those guests from 2017. So look back with us as we remember some of the most notable events in health policy in the past year. Efforts to repeal the ACA, global health advocates who met the challenges of recent natural disasters, state health commissioners who tackled the big public health issues on the front lines, and the promise of new technologies such as gene editing, telemedicine, and blockchain. They are poised to disrupt the healthcare industry as we know it.
Well, you know, Mark, when we launched this show back in 2009, we wanted to offer a forum where the best minds in the industry could help us understand the changes underway in health policy with the Affordable Health Care Act, but also everything that was going on in the technology front with innovations across the healthcare spectrum that we knew would influence the healthcare of the future. And it seems the future is here. 9 years later, we're still watching dramatic events unfold, from continued changes to health policy to the enormous opioid crisis to the advent of exciting new technologies that will and are transforming care delivery. It's been a time of enormous uncertainty and change, but I think we'd say there's been a lot of excitement and great promise as well.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, Margaret. And, you know, we kicked off 2017 with a great conversation with the Honorable Michael Levitt, former HHS secretary under the elder President George Bush. He now runs one of the most influential conservative consultancies on health policy in this country. Governor Levitt served in an advisory capacity to the Trump transition team and speculated at time of our interview on what the administration would do well to focus in on its approach to health reform. He also warned that the GOP leadership should not attempt to overreach.
The one certainty in the next several months about health care is that there will be a bill that will pass Congress that will be titled Repeal and Replace. What is uncertain is what they will define repeal to mean and what they will define replace to mean. Pretending that the law never happened is not an option. But the Republicans have, for three elections in a row, campaigned that they would repeal and replace the law, and I think they have no alternative but to fulfill that. And there will be parts of the Affordable Care Act that, in fact, can be changed. And I think one area that we'll look quickly to see will be, obviously, the individual mandate. I think that's likely to disappear. Now, the problem that all of this brings is they do have to replace this because there are 20 million people who now have coverage and many other Americans whose health care will be affected by this. So at least their appearance right now is that they will give themselves some time in which to actually formulate the replacement. One of the commitments that Republicans have made is that they don't intend to do this in a way that does not involve a bipartisan support. One of the primary mistakes that was made in the passage of the Affordable Care Act is that it was done entirely on a partisan basis, and they seem committed not to make that mistake again. The most important change that has occurred in health care potentially over the last 60 years is the transition from fee-for-service payment to some type of payment where providers are paid on the basis of value. Will this transition from fee-for-service to value payment continue under the new administration? And I think the answer to that is yes. It's being driven by an economic imperative that if we want to continue to have great health care, we have to change the way it's paid for, because there's no way we can continue to spend an increasing share of the American economy on one thing, health care. So the only thing to do, and the smart thing to do, is to change the way we pay for it. And I believe that the Trump administration will not only agree with that, but they may in fact hasten it.
On that note, Mark, we welcomed conservative policy analyst Lan-Hee Chen, Director of Domestic Policy Studies at Stanford University and Research Fellow at the conservative Hoover Institution. He gave us an analysis of why he thought the House GOP health reform bill, the American Health Care Act, had failed.
Sure. Well, you know, I've described the failure of the American Health Care Act as a self-inflicted wound as well. And Republicans had an opportunity here to advance legislation that would have taken steps in the right direction, I think, in terms of thinking about our health care system. It certainly was an opportunity to advance some important goals. For example, reform of Medicaid, curbing of some of the regulatory regime created by the Affordable Care Act, et cetera. And really, this was one of those situations where Republicans knew that Democrats were going to oppose the bill and do so with relative unanimity. For Republicans, though, they were the ones who ended up holding this bill up. And whether you blame some of the moderate Republican faction or some of the more conservative hardline Freedom Caucus, either way, Republicans really were the ones who prevented this legislation from advancing. And so what's disappointing about this was the inability of Republicans to get together and agree that the American Health Care Act was a valuable vehicle moving forward. The bill got pulled, and we're in a situation now where any progress on repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act has become that much more difficult.
We've seen a rise in the poll around the popularity of the Affordable Care Act. And I'm wondering, what do you think the next steps are going to be for Congress?
I think they have to really seriously consider whether, in fact, they're committed to repeal and to replacement of the law of Obamacare. And if they are, I think they have to ask themselves, what are the measures and steps they can take to do that? I think, first of all, there are things about Obamacare that suggest that in some markets there is some serious issues. And, for example, the stability of insurance markets in many states. It seems to me that there are a whole set of ways that the Trump administration, for example, can try to open things up for states. One of the things that's interesting about the Affordable Care Act is even if it's never repealed, there is a provision in it that allows states to create innovative health reforms on their own.
Mm-hmm.
In the absence of a federal consensus around how to move forward on Obamacare, are there ways that various states can pursue their own reforms that are consistent with what people in that state want, mm-hmm. even if it's different from the architecture set out by Obamacare?
And speaking of reform, and Margaret, I think we always talk about states as incubators for change. We had some interesting innovations at the state level. Dr. Jennifer Walthall, Secretary of the Indiana Families and Social Service Administration, she joined us on the show this past year and helped us understand this innovative approach to Medicaid expansion.
The Healthy Indiana Plan actually predated Medicaid expansion. This model is built on the theory that we can be partners with people to navigate their way into the commercial health access market through engagement and support, but that takes a lot of effort together as partners. And in order to achieve that goal, we have to support and build infrastructure for a healthy workforce. HIP is described as a consumer-directed approach to health coverage that actually replaces traditional Medicaid in Indiana for all non-disabled Hoosiers ages 19 to 64. And it's referred to as consumer-directed because the basic and routine costs of healthcare are paid by the patient-managed account versus the insurance company. And this is to promote consumer behavior by giving patients greater control over their own health budgets and the healthcare that they receive. HIP is structured so that it pays doctors more to care for members. So instead of reimbursing doctors at Medicaid rates, HIP 2.0 pays Medicare rates, which are significantly higher. And this has helped recruit over 6,000 new healthcare providers into the Medicaid network, which has increased access to care for our members.
But I'm also curious about the role that other organizations like community health centers may have played in helping to fill that primary care gap with so many newly uninsured residents. And as you know, the longer people were out of care, the more likely they had pent-up demand.
You bet. We've seen an incredible surge of partnerships around the primary care space, both from community health centers and also from bringing in a primary care workforce. And one of the things that I've been very excited to be part of is the governor's health workforce commission, really filling those primary care deserts for the state so that we improve access to health care in general. In HIP in particular, about 87% of our HIP Plus members used preventive health services during their first year of enrollment. So that's a pretty big deal.
Absolutely.
In my mind.
Yep.
And staying with our theme of the states, we welcomed Louisiana's Health Secretary, Dr. Rebecca Gee. She noted the significant increase in health coverage in her state when newly elected Governor John Bel Edwards expanded Medicaid. Her office, of course, was instrumental in helping the region prepare for Hurricanes Harvey and Irma, sharing the lessons they had learned the hard way from Hurricane Katrina. And she talked about how Louisiana prepared differently for these storms as a direct result of what they went through and, most importantly, what they learned and prepared for.
There were many mistakes made. Some of them were just because no city of that size had endured a hurricane disaster of that proportion. You know, 25,000 individuals had to be evacuated post-storm. Almost 2,000 people lost their lives. In Katrina, there was a lot of communication going in different directions, but we didn't have a disaster response network. We now do. We have a central command. I have operations center where we coordinate all of the healthcare activities for the state. We also focus on pre-storm evacuation. So prior to Katrina, folks hadn't experienced that level of devastation. Now we really insist that everyone leave. And we have a very robust medical institution evacuation plan. So in the wake of Katrina, we developed new and robust primary care facilities in the New Orleans area. But I think more importantly was the decision that Governor Edwards made to expand Medicaid. Here in Louisiana, we have a large number of working poor folks who, one in four of them, were uninsured. No way to access primary care except for, you know, if they went to a charity facility or an emergency room. Now, nearly 440,000 adults, many for the first time in their lives, have access to primary care. And we know that over 100,000 of them have received preventive health services. Tens of thousands have gotten a colonoscopy. 19,000 women have gotten diagnostic breast imaging. Over 30,000 were treated for depression or mental illness. And that's something that we realize post-storm. When they lose their homes, lose everything they've worked for, that sometimes potentiates mental illness and stress. And so having a whole system of care for them where they have insurance, can go to a federally qualified health center, that has been a real sea change for Louisiana.
But with so much turmoil happening around the world and the ongoing refugee crisis, we welcome Save the Children CEO Carolyn Miles. Their 2017 report on the end of childhood was a sobering wake-up call on the plight of so many of the world's children.
So we looked at actually 8 what we call childhood enders, things like child mortality, so children being killed, malnutrition, which stunts children not just physically, but it stunts their growth mentally, being out of school, so having an end to their education, child labor, child marriage, which we know for girls particularly is a huge ender of childhood, and then forced displacement by conflict, so being a refugee or being displaced inside your country. Those are the things that really, we believe, end childhood. And refugees and the inability to live in your home is one of those enders. Girls who are married as children, most of them will drop out of school. They will then usually have a child within a very short time of being married, the age of 13 or 14. So you'll have higher rates of child deaths, prenatal issues, and then those children don't get an opportunity to go to school. So, you know, one of the best things to protect children is to really move that age of marriage up.
Yep.
For girls.
And Michael Nienhuis, CEO of AmeriCares, talked about the devastation wrought by the back-to-back hurricanes that struck in 2017.
We're really focused on supporting local health infrastructure, you know, before a disaster, in the midst of it, afterwards in recovery, and then sort of ongoing in a longer-term way. We focus on local health centers, building their capacity to serve the health needs in their community. And one critical way that we do that is making sure they have access to medicines and medical supplies. So we do have a large logistical operation that that distributes medicines and supplies. And then our work goes beyond that to build the capacity of these local health centers.
Margaret, it was a breakout year for gene editing and CRISPR technology, with some of the first notable treatments in humans setting the stage for what could truly be an era of personalized medicine. We had Dr. Samir Damani on with us recently, a founder of Mint Health, one of the handfuls of entities looking to utilize blockchain in healthcare.
40 to 56 million annual deaths that occur globally occur from preventable chronic conditions. And patients today have taken a passive position in their health due to payer and provider kind of dominance. And so what blockchain enables, it enables a self-sovereign, patient-controlled health record that's tied to a global, unique identifier. It allows for the seamless and secure transfer of clinical and behavioral data between patient-authorized stakeholders. And so blockchain is essentially a decentralized ledger of all transactions across the peer-to-peer network. And using this technology, any participant can confirm the transactions without the need for any kind of central certifying authority. This requested transaction is actually broadcast to a peer-to-peer network of computers known as nodes. These nodes then validate the transactions and the user status through algorithms. And there's a hash that represents the block. And there's a mathematical formula that has to be solved. And that's what this peer-to-peer global network, open source, is actually doing. What this allows is, you know, at least in healthcare, what can happen now is blockchain essentially eliminates the middleman, allows for seamless and secure transfer of data or information. And that gives patients control.
Earlier this year, we welcomed Dr. Peter Yelilees on the show. He's the president of the American Telemedicine Association. He talked about the coming wave of digital natives in the healthcare landscape who will begin to drive the demand for telemedicine protocols across the healthcare industry.
I mean, the difference is, now, just, you know, you can do more on your phone now than you could on those early systems that I spent an enormous amount of money on. There's been also a huge change in attitudes, particularly with the younger generation. People under 30, you know, we typically think of as being digital natives who've never lived without the internet and who have different expectations of being able to get information immediately. And then people always used to think of telemedicine or using these technologies as being an either-or choice situation. Mm-hmm. And the reality of life is that increasing numbers of patients are being seen in a hybrid manner. You know, they sometimes see their doctor in person, they sometimes see them online. And essentially, the doctor-patient relationship nowadays has become a much more fluid and, quite honestly, better relationship. For many years in psychiatry, we've done what we call curbside consultations, mm-hmm. so that a primary care doc will ring a psychiatrist, will, you know, have maybe a 2 to 4 minute conversation with that person. The psychiatrist will give them an opinion. All we're doing with the asynchronous telepsychiatry is saying, but why don't we actually record the patient? And instead of me just ringing you about the patient, I can actually send you a recording of the patient. Mm-hmm. You can get to see what they look like. You can get mm-hmm. to see how they answer. Mm-hmm. And then you can give me an opinion. It's really very simple. We've done a number of studies showing that you can be just as accurate diagnostically. We are able, however, to monitor people, and we've been doing a study recently looking at several hundred patients who have chronic medical and psychiatric illnesses, and we're doing these asynchronous consultations every 6 months to basically help the primary care doc with their overall management mm-hmm. Of their patient.
I'm reminded of our interview with Apple's chief operating officer, Jeff Williams, who talked about the promise of the Apple Watch as research and health monitoring tool. The recently announced Apple Heart study is now allowing millions of Apple Watch users to download a free app that identifies irregular heartbeats and if AFib is detected. They are swiftly linked to a telehealth physician through American Well, a company founded by our recent guest, Roy and Ido Schoenberg. The brothers and entrepreneurs shared why they think the Apple Health Heart Study is a turning point for the use of telemedicine in healthcare and research.
If you realize what corner telemedicine has gone by when the Apple Heart Study was announced, you know, if you think about the way that medicine has always been, there were really two ways in which medicine intervened. Either we showed up when we were very sick, or in some ways, healthcare developed ways in which occasionally, if we were, you know, willing to do so, it would take a snapshot of where we are and try to identify early certain diseases. But with the heart study, we kind of crossed a certain line because for the first time, we're saying healthcare is not going to wait until you show up with a certain healthcare condition, but rather we're actually going to go to where you are. We're going to kind of live with you and try to do our best to understand whether certain things that are happening with you and your body may indicate that some kind of treatment or some kind of intervention is needed. That's a radical departure in the philosophy of how we do medicine, and I think this is really the corner that the Apple Heart study signifies.
We see something pretty amazing, that the first time that a tool that is used by consumers, which inherently is not a medical device, can be so instrumental to help us understand something that could have a potential far-reaching clinical impact. What we hope the study will be able to show, to find people that could warrant medical attention far sooner than any other medical intervention. And so we have this tool that we use every day that listens to our body. Not everybody have access to the best thought leaders in Stanford every day. And then we are able to close the loop with board-certified providers that show up much quicker than any other alternative to help navigate and understand the finding.
You know, Mark, I'm reminded every single week on the show that while health policy continues to morph and change in the shifting political landscape, we are on the front line watching a transformative healthcare revolution underway. It's incredibly exciting, and I think we're really looking forward to discovering new breakthroughs in 2018. In the meantime, for our listeners, if you want to tap into our more than 400 shows, please go to our website, www.chcradio.com. And thank you so much for listening. We've got more great guests in the queue for 2018 here on Conversations on Healthcare. Can't wait to bring them to you.
Onward. Peace and health. At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
At the end of each year, we chronicle the worst political falsehoods, or what we call the whoppers of the year. Our roundup for 2017 includes several items on healthcare. At a campaign-style rally in Kentucky in March, President Donald Trump falsely said, quote, many of our best and brightest are leaving the medical profession entirely because of Obamacare. The number of active physicians increased 8% from 2010, when the Affordable Care Act became law, to 2015, the most recent data available from the Association of American Medical Colleges. Earlier this year, Trump also wrongly claimed, quote, Obamacare covers very few people. But the number of Americans without health insurance had fallen by 20 million since the ACA was enacted. That's according to the National Health Interview Survey published by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And without evidence, Trump said that by allowing insurers to sell plans across state lines, premiums would go down 60% and 70%. The White House provided no support for those figures. Experts told us they knew of no study to back up the claim, and they disputed the idea that average premiums would drop significantly. The president wasn't the only one to sidestep the facts. We chronicled several claims about the Republican efforts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. For instance, House Speaker Paul Ryan and Independent Senator Bernie Sanders both distorted the Congressional Budget Office's analysis of the Republican bill. Sanders claimed it would, quote, throw 22 million Americans off of health insurance, while Ryan said no one would be thrown off insurance. Quote, it's that people will choose not to buy something they don't like or want, he said. Actually, CBO said the bill would reduce the number of people with health insurance by 22 million through a combination of both. Some would voluntarily choose not to buy insurance, but others would no longer be eligible for Medicaid or would not be able to afford coverage. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.